Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Trump vetoes bill to end U.S. involvement in Saudi-led Yemen war. President Trump vetoed a resolution passed by Congress to end U.S. military assistance in Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. The veto, the second in his presidency, it was expected, and Congress lacks the votes to override it. But passing the never-before-used War Powers Resolution has been viewed as a milestone for lawmakers who have shown a renewed willingness to assert their war-making authority after letting it atrophy for decades under presidents from both parties. Well, what does this mean going forward? For the answer to this, we turn to my first guest. She's the editor-in-chief at Inside Arabia, Elizabeth Myers. Elizabeth, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much, Dr. Leon. Great to be back.
So let's just start with the general question. Your thoughts on when you heard that the president had done what was expected and vetoed the bill?
Well, of course, it was not unexpected, as you say, but my thoughts were how absolutely appalling to allow a situation to continue to escalate the way it has going on now we're getting into the fifth year now of this war, where it has created, in particular, the airstrikes themselves by the Saudi and Emirati-led coalition that the United States is supporting have created, caused the most casualties amongst the civilians, the most infrastructure damage, the most damage and destruction of hospitals, roads, all of the things, water facilities, all of the essential facilities that the people need to live over there or to move their food, to get their food. It's created an absolutely extraordinary situation that the UN Secretary General, just a year ago, it's been a full year since he said it was the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
I mentioned in my opening that they failed to pass the War Powers Resolution, and that it's viewed as a milestone for lawmakers who've shown a renewed willingness to assert war-making authority, to assert their war-making authority. But is that really true? When we look at how both parties are supporting the president on his moves in Venezuela, as we look at their resolute complicity in Syria, it's not so much they're deciding to take over their power in terms of war powers. It really seems more as though they were just so revolted in the killing, in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Prince Bonesaw, that they had to react to that instead of the actual atrocities that were going on in Yemen.
I think that has been a catalyzing force for both houses of Congress. But I don't agree that that's the only thing that's pushed them to the brink here. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the special but toxic arrangement, shall we say, with Saudi Arabia that they see it being problematic. And I think that it unfortunately did take the killing of a very high-profile journalist who happened to be a Saudi but who was a Virginia resident and wrote for the Washington Post to kind of bring this revulsion, if you will, to the forefront. But I think perhaps, you know, this is the first use of the War Powers Act resolution since the act was first enacted back in 1973. And I think it's been, there's sort of been a trend. The president has, by and large, driven foreign policy. But in this particular instance, the Congress was looking at, well, who has the war powers here under our Constitution? And that's clearly the Congress. Now, obviously, there are those who disagree, including the president and his administration, who have said in the statement issuing the veto that this is not troops on the ground, this is not war. But nevertheless, we are making it certainly possible for this coalition to exact the most damage that they can possibly do unfortunately, quite indiscriminately. And we are helping them to do that because we provide them logistics and intelligence and all kinds of help to do with this military capability. So I think there are others who say this is a matter of degree. And essentially, the U.S. is helping these countries, these formerly nine countries of the coalition, wage war on one of the poorest countries in the Middle East and North Africa area.
Listen to these two descriptions, one from the Chicago Tribune and one from the Washington Post, and let me know if I'm being too sensitive here. The Tribune says, quote, "The U.S. provides billions of dollars of arms to the Saudi-led coalition fighting against Iran-backed rebels in Yemen." The Post says, "The veto means the United States will continue its involvement in Saudi Arabia's bombing campaign against Yemen's Houthi rebels, waged in the name of holding back Iran's expansion in the region," end quote. Is the reference to Iran-backed rebels and the Post's holding back Iran's expansion in the region, is that U.S. rhetoric to bolster a narrative? I mean, how relevant are those points, and how accurate are those points in the context of the bigger picture? The U.S. is backing the largest man-made humanitarian crisis in history.
Yeah, I think there is some truth to the fact that Iran has provided arms to the Houthi rebels. But let's recall that the Houthis are Yemenis. They are Yemeni people who rose up in 2014 against the sitting government on the basis of claims of corruption, claims of all kinds of abuses by the sitting government. And we are supporting, actually, the Saudi agenda of bringing that narrative of an anti-Iran narrative into it. In fact, this war is far more complicated than two parties, one being supported by the U.S. and one being supported by Iran. There are multiple factions in this war. You have Al-Qaeda. You have other smaller factions that are offshoots of the original Houthi rebels. It's much more complicated than just to say, well, we're in it because we're keeping Iran from expanding.
And that's my point.
It's not as simple as that, and it should not be viewed as such. These are Yemenis who want their country. They want their country back, essentially.
So to me, with the way that—and I just picked these two because there are others that have done the same— to me, with what the Tribune has done and with what the Post have done, they're kind of talking out both sides of their mouth in that they want, on the one hand, to report the fact that the president, in vetoing this bill, is making a big mistake. But then they seem, by injecting the Iran issue into this story, they want to try to validate his move.
Right. They're trying to support the president's narrative that
exactly.
He's protecting
U.S. interests,
our interests in the region, by supporting the Saudis and the Emiratis and basically scorching. It's scorched earth policy is what's going on there. And not just earth, but people, and people dying of famine now, and malnutrition, and babies,
and cholera.
All kinds of, because they cannot get access to clean water now. They have no food, they have no clean water, and they're just literally slowly dying in their houses. And they can't, and partly because they cannot even access the roads. Some of the food convoys that were being arranged the last time that you and I talked were in danger of being bombed. Food convoys, humanitarian relief convoys, not getting to where it needs to go. So this is. I'm afraid that we're not looking at any kind of override possibility here either. So what does that leave us at this point? I think that leaves us with relying on the UN to step in and get the negotiations back on the table again with all parties, not just with the the sitting government, but with all parties to the war.
It was a month or so, or maybe a little longer, that we were looking at a ceasefire. We were looking at Hodeida possibly becoming viable and open for business. And we spoke about this a couple of months ago, and now it seems as though that never happened.
Yeah, and it's my understanding, based on what I've heard just this week, Hodeida is still subject to blockade. So the A, and that is the major port of entry that where food aid, medicines, and or clean water would be coming through, and it's still subject to a blockade.
In his State of the Union address in February, the president declared, "Great nations do not fight endless wars," to which Democrat Ro Khanna, who was the lead sponsor of the bill in the House of Representatives, said, quote, "From a president elected on the promise of putting a stop to endless wars, this veto is a painful missed opportunity." Your thoughts?
Yeah, and not only that, but it seemed to be incongruous with his other actions. When you think about, for example, the glee with which he announced that al-Qaeda was defeated in Syria and all of the U.S. troops would be pulled out immediately. Remember that?
I do remember that.
So we had that. We have the troops in Afghanistan being pulled out. And this is, even with, his speed and haste in doing that was criticized by major military officials who thought that was not a good policy. But here you have almost a no-brainer to simply stop the support and stop the arms for the coalition forces. And it just seems totally incongruous to his haste to stop our interventions in Afghanistan and Syria and his slowness to stop it here. And, it just leads me to wonder what is the actual motivation here?
Ro Khanna went on to say, quote, "This resolution nonetheless was a major win. It sends a clear signal to the Saudis that they need to lift their blockade and allow humanitarian assistance into Yemen if they care about their relationship with Congress," end quote. First, I don't think the Saudis care about their relationship with Congress. And second, going back to and this is where I got some of my opening from, about this is a major win, it sends the clear signal. To me, that's an example of winning the battle, but losing the war, and no pun intended there.
Yeah, I think at this particular moment in time where they have such unconditional support and endorsement and participation from the executive branch, they really don't need Congress at all, especially when the executive branch has, the veto power, and an override is nowhere near on the cards for probably much of anything. I mean, I think we're going to have to see what happens with the 2020 election and see where that gets us. More Democrats.
To that point, is this a viable electoral issue? Is this a viable campaign issue? Your organization, Inside Arabia, launched an information campaign during the UN meetings in September. I think you got tremendous response from that. Could this issue, and should the Democrats make this an issue in the campaign going forward?
Well, I think they should unless they're talking out two sides of their mouth.
Mm.
Because from a strictly humanitarian standpoint, I mean, keep the politics outside of it for the moment, this is a no-brainer. This is destroying one of the oldest civilizations on the planet, one of the oldest basins of culture and history.
But here's the problem I see, and we have just about a couple minutes left. I want to get this in so you can wrap it up. Here's a problem with Nancy Pelosi or any of the other Democrats using this as a campaign issue. It was greenlit by Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's true, but I don't see that's necessarily a problem at this point. That was 2015. We weren't in this humanitarian crisis then. Yemen was not in such a terrible situation. And nor is Barack Obama president at this point.
But that would be the rebuttal coming from the Republican side. You all greenlit this under a Democratic president.
And that means we have to continue it to the death?
Oh, not at all. No. I'm just throwing out the other side of the argument. That's all.
Right, exactly. But I'm just, you know, the other side of that argument is because we started something, it doesn't mean we
exactly.
have to finish something.
So exactly.
The death of every single last living civilian, woman, baby, and child in that country. I mean, this is where it is. This is 24 million people. That's almost the entire population of Yemen mm-hmm. are in need of humanitarian relief. People are dying. Every 10 minutes, you have one person dying. I mean, I don't understand what we are reaping, what benefits we are reaping out of this, except for this special relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, well, we're pushing back the marching hordes of Iranians that are trying to take over the world. There you go. That's the answer. Your laughter is the answer.
Yeah, it's specious and simplistic.
How can people, real quick, Elizabeth, how can people get information from Inside Arabia on this issue?
Yes, you can reach us on the web at insidearabia.com, https://insidearabia.com. We have a number of articles that we have published periodically on this, on all aspects, the political, the cultural, the social, all aspects. And we welcome your feedback. We're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay, great. Inside Arabia, my guest, Elizabeth Myers, editor-in-chief at Inside Arabia. As always, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your coming on board with us. Thank you for your insight and for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
It's my pleasure. I only wish it were under better circumstances.
Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. We just got to keep up the dialogue and the pressure. We will get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wilmer.
All right. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, be careful what you pray for, because you just might get it. The Mueller report will be released tomorrow, Thursday. After 23 months, 500 search warrants, 2,300 subpoenas, and a string of indictments, the results of the investigation by the special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III, will be public tomorrow in a nearly 400-page report. Well, what should we expect, and what does this mean going forward? Well, for this, we turn to my next guest. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. You know him through his investigative reports for BBC Television, The Guardian, Democracy Now!, and Rolling Stone. He recently released the post-election update of his film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election, which you can find on Amazon and Prime or at GregPalast.com. He is Greg Palast. As always, Greg, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be with you, Wilmer.
So, did you buy bags of popcorn? How are you planning to deal with the release of the report?
God. The Russia thing has been a horrible distraction. And now the Democrats are going to pay a heavy, heavy price because, you know, I agree, Attorney General Barr is a political hack of the worst order. He basically auditioned for the post by saying, the president can't obstruct justice by definition, et cetera. And the president doesn't have to release the Mueller report, and there shouldn't be a special counsel and all this stuff. And so Trump appointed him attorney general. All this stinks. But you know what? Guess what? I think that there's no news here for most of your listeners that Donald Trump is not King David. He's not a great statesman. He's not a great leader. He's a dangerous character. But what he isn't is a guy who he didn't need the Russians to elect him. he kind of needed Hillary Clinton to elect him. And, you know, that was the problem. And so now the Democrats are looking at their shoes and whistling and saying things like Hakeem Jeffries, who is the head of the Democratic caucus, is saying, we didn't run on Russia. We didn't run on collusion or obstruction of justice. Democrats ran on infrastructure. Democrats ran on health care. Democrats ran on democracy. And I think what he means is, you know, fighting suppression of the vote and giving people the right to vote. And he's right. These are the issues. There's no question that the Democrats took back control of Congress by running on what they call kitchen table issues. People don't care about Russia. They don't buy the story. And when Mueller says, well, he hasn't exonerated Trump on obstruction of justice, this is not a deep investigation. This was, Trump's active intent or attempt to obstruct justice is out there for everyone to see and for the voters to make decisions on. You know, he fired Comey because he didn't want Comey digging into his activities or his businesses. You know, he kept threatening to shut down the Mueller investigation, which he didn't. And so Mueller's leaving saying, well, you know, there you have it. It's up to Congress to determine if there's obstruction of justice. And if you think so, impeach the guy, you know. So, but what happened here is we got this big, so now the Democrats are really, really concerned because they know that this redacted report's going to come out. And I agree, it shouldn't be redacted. This is our document, this isn't the personal property of Mr. Barr. And I agree with the Democrats, it shouldn't come out. But it's the game of saying what we're not seeing is the real stuff. And I hate to say it, two things. Number one, I don't think Mueller will allow himself to be misrepresented. That's number one. Mm-hmm. If you think that Mueller is going to say, yeah, but they left out the stuff where I said that he, you know, that the Russians, you know, had fixed all the voting machines in Ohio or something, you know, it's at Trump's request. I'm sure if that was in there, Mueller would not just let someone cross it out and say that's okay.
So wait a minute. So to that point, Barr said last month in his book report that the special counsel did not find anyone associated with the Trump campaign worked with the Russian government to illegally influence the election, and he also said there was insufficient evidence that Trump illegally obstructed justice. If those two points were misrepresenting Mueller's findings, I have been saying, and I think this is what you're saying, Mueller would have jumped in by now and said, nope, that's not what I said.
Yeah, because first of all, he is reporting to Congress, and then Mueller would have another crime, which is... This deceiving Congress is a crime, and as special counsel, which is because it's a related topic, and he literally has the right to handcuff Barr.
Right.
You know, I mean, Mueller's still in charge. You know, he's still the special counsel, and he still has special authority. And if he was misrepresented, in effect, it's not because Barr isn't under oath, but so it's not perjury, but it is an attempt to defraud and deceive Congress if that's what he's doing.
He did send a document to Congress, and so that would be misleading Congress.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. And remember that Mueller and Barr go way back.
They're buddies. They're good buddies.
They're buddies. They went to, if I remember, they went to each other's daughters' weddings, at least one of those weddings where they were together. And they're old friends. They've worked together.
Right.
I think it's, you know, I know, obviously Barr is, and I said, he's a partisan hack. There's no doubt about it. He should not be attorney general now. He should not have been attorney general before. But we have to say that, you know, that it's inconceivable that Mueller would just let someone literally, completely and utterly misrepresent his report. I assume that it was toned down, et cetera. And remember, he didn't exonerate Trump on obstruction of justice. But like I say, there's no secret special information on that. We all know, you know, just by turning on TV, that Trump was saying, I can fire this guy.
Right.
I got rid of Comey. You know, he tried to, you know, stop the investigation by getting rid of Comey. But, you know, the investigation went ahead, and there it was. And, you know, I mean, I'm still – what interests me is I'm kind of interested in statements in the information about Jared Kushner and others in the campaign and Manafort.
Right.
But remember, the big secret stuff there ain't so secret. We do know that they had a meeting with a woman that does Russian adoptions, you know, and she said she had hot stuff on Hillary Clinton, and it turned out to be anything you can Google, you know. And, you know, that was the big, you know, they're idiots for going to this woman, but that's, you know.
They're idiots.
Being an idiot is not by itself a crime in America, because if so, we'd have three quarters of Congress locked up, you know. So, you know, I mean, it's at this point, it's becoming a national joke and a national embarrassment. And you know what? The Democrats should have learned something. They are absolutely correct now when they're trying to change the tune,
right,
saying, oh, let's talk about health care. You know what, guys? If you had talked about health care during the 2016 campaign instead of crapping all over Medicare for all, if you had talked about student debt instead of, you know, saying that Bernie Sanders is out of his mind for saying that people shouldn't be bankrupted putting their kids through college in America
and going to medical school.
If they talked about these issues, if they said black people should be allowed to cast their votes in Georgia and Ohio and Michigan, if they had raised those issues, if they had made those the issues, it would be President Clinton. And, you know, Trump would just be another failed real estate mogul. And so, yeah, I'm glad they're changing the subject 2 years too late. And the fact that they took back Congress, it wasn't on Russia. There was no one except my congressman, Adam Schiff, but he runs unopposed here. So he can blather idiocies all he wants because he's unopposed. Unfortunately, I feel unrepresented in my district. Because he's off on the Russian front while we have homeless people outside my door. Come on, Adam, let's get back to work now, and let's talk about taking care of America. And unfortunately, they're setting up Trump for re-election unless they do make this shift completely and quickly. Because, you know, I mean, they, you know, Hillary Clinton was still defending NAFTA in Michigan, in Detroit. She was defending NAFTA in Ohio. And now Trump was saying NAFTA's got to go. You know, he lied right about that. He lied. Right. He lied about a lot of things, but at least he was talking the issues. And you know, Hillary Clinton was saying everything is fine in the economy in Michigan and Ohio. It's fine in New York. It's fine here on the West Coast. But in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, I was there. These are devastated states, and Trump spoke to that devastation, and you have to remember, Hillary and the Democrats are pushing the Russia thing before the election, and it didn't go anywhere.
That takes me to this question. Hillary was pushing Russiagate, and Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries, you know, just about, a whole lot of Democrats were telling us, wait till the Mueller report. Wait till the Mueller report. And then the Mueller report, well, then Barr's letter comes out and it doesn't give them what they want. So then it's, we got to see the whole thing. We got to see the whole thing. And now today, that since the report is due out tomorrow, you've got Hakeem Jeffries, you've got Nancy Pelosi saying, well, yeah, it's going to be kind of important, but people are really concerned about kitchen table issues, not to mention what mainstream media was, how they ran with this thing ad nauseum. How do they make the shift and be credible in the process?
Well, they give each other awards. Jake Tapper has all kinds of awards for the story that never happened.
Because Russiagate was the existential threat to our democracy. We're supposed to be finding Russians under every rock. And you better check your emails because Vladimir Putin is sending you a message that is supposed to warp your mind and have you vote however.
Well, no, I mean, Vladimir Putin did fix the election because I think he's the one that told Hillary Clinton, whatever you do, don't campaign in Wisconsin.
Yeah, he did tell her that.
Yeah, he told her, don't campaign in Wisconsin. And don't mention vote suppression because, you know.
Right, he did tell her that.
So he was the one who said, and yeah, it wasn't Putin, who removed 340,134 voters illegally in Georgia. It wasn't Vlad Putin who said, don't count 75,000 ballots in Michigan.
Oh, he didn't say that?
It wasn't Vlad Putin who said, you know, defend the wonders of free trade and the WTO and NAFTA in Wisconsin, when you had, you know, Janesville and those industrial areas shut down. I mean, the Democrats had the issues handed to them. Janesville was represented by Paul Ryan. I'm going to tell you, the reason Paul Ryan gave up the speakership and didn't run is not because he wanted to spend more time with his family. It's because he wouldn't have been reelected.
Right.
Let me repeat that. He wouldn't have been. And the Democrats had Wisconsin in their hands. As we now see, when they switched out of their BS and got out of the nonsense that NAFTA is wonderful, that the Wisconsin economy is wonderful, and, you know, just listen to the Clintons. When they changed that tune, the Democrats took back Wisconsin and got rid of Scott Walker. I mean, the midterms was a real lesson because the local politicians said, we are not going with the Democratic Party, national Russia stuff. We're not going with the nonsense because people in our district don't care, and it's not believable. The truth is, okay, if there really was, first of all, you know, we're talking about the Mueller report. There's one line. I worked with the Justice Department. Wilmer, I did, mm-hmm. you know, in racketeering, et cetera.
Right.
And I've done other work with the FBI. There's one important phrase in the report that's not much repeated. The answer is there are no more indictments.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
There are no more indictments. Okay. If there was a crime, whether he can or cannot indict the president, I don't know. He could recommend it, or he could recommend impeachment, or he could say, here's evidence of an indictable offense. But he did not.
Correct.
Okay. Now, the other is that the only indictment that came out after the report, because it was basically already done but hadn't been unsealed, mm-hmm. is against one of Clinton's lawyers, and who then laundered money for the accusation is that this lawyer who actually worked for Bill Clinton but then decided to make a few bucks switching sides allegedly laundered some money from a Ukrainian for tickets for Trump's inauguration. And that's what the indictment is about. But, you know, it's, you know, they didn't come up with the interference in the race. And we've talked about this. There are really serious issues of interference, but it's by the Republican Party. As I said on MSNBC when I was last allowed on, when they said, is the Russia going to fix, do you worry that Russian hackers will fix the voting machines in Ohio? And I said, I'm more worried about the guys who have the passwords and control those machines, the Republicans. They don't need any help from some hacker in Moscow. I'm worried about the guys, the Republicans in Ohio fixing that election, which they did, but they did it by removing and blockading African Americans from voting, 7-hour lines. I was there. That's how they fixed the election. And there were no Russians blocking the entrances to the polling stations. There were Republicans.
They were also, you have the letter from Diebold. Now, this is, I think, back in 2000. You have the letter from Diebold to the then Secretary of State of Ohio saying, I will deliver the election to George Bush through any mechanisms necessary, correct?
Yeah, it wasn't written in Cyrillic. You know,
no.
It was, this is like, you know, so what's happening is what I'm grateful for is that, you know, it ended with a whimper, not a bang. But I'm glad it's ending. And I'm glad that Pelosi is finally saying, we're out of here. Okay. Obviously they're not going to apologize.
Which they should.
Because the truth is that the local Dems, that people running for whether it's governor of Wisconsin or Congress or anything, that basically Russiagate was never, ever an issue that meant anything to anyone in the United States because it wasn't. I think, by the way, if there really was some severe evidence of collusion with a foreign power, I think that would have had a now that's serious, but we didn't see it.
Right.
And you know, when you're talking about a few bucks here and there, I broke the story back in the '90s. One of my first stories that I broke back in November of 2000 was about Chinese money going into the Clinton campaign, $1 million in Chinese money. Now, I don't think that is what elected. That didn't elect Bill Clinton,
right.
But, you know, $1 million in Chinese money is not something we should be applauding. And if there's indictments to be had, you know, maybe that was when we should have been indicting the president, you know. But, yeah, and it's to every nation's advantage in this world, because the president of the United States is in effect almost president of the planet. And so there's always going to be attempts to manipulate. And in fact, for example, the dictator, the brutal, vicious, bloodthirsty dictator of Kazakhstan, gave Bill Clinton a $500,000 speaking fee for a little speech for a day, and Clinton got a $500,000. This was not for the foundation. This is Clinton's pocket. $500,000 to Bill Clinton because his wife was Secretary of State, the foreign minister.
There we go.
Which would control and suppose and everyone assumed she would be the next president. So you pay her husband, the last president,
$500,000.
Now it could be that, I mean, Bill Clinton has said that none of the money paid for me has affected anything that Hillary Clinton did as Secretary of State and would have affected anything she would have done as president. However, $500,000 from a foreign power seeking favors, which they got from the Clinton State Department, that's pretty creepy stuff. And it really skirts very close to violation of the Emoluments Clause, where, yes, Hillary Clinton was barred from taking money from a foreign power, but as she and Bill note, that they file a joint tax return and they have joint bank accounts. So the money went into Hillary Clinton's bank account, but that's not a violation of the Emoluments Clause. That's not accepting money illegally from a foreign power. That's one of the few crimes listed in the U.S. Constitution.
In the Constitution, exactly.
And, you know, so, but you know what the truth is? I don't think that Hillary should be in leg irons for that. It's because you know why? I made it public. It was public, and people got to look at that and say, we'll vote for her or we won't. And she did lose a lot of votes because a lot of people just decided, yeah, she's corrupt Hillary, crooked Hillary.
I got to stop you there, but I can tell you one thing that President Putin did do was post in social media that Hillary Clinton, in wanting to get out the African-American vote, should not spend any money with black media. that's another reason she lost. We can blame him for that.
I can tell you that. I know they, and I, you know, just another quick thing on that, I can tell you, and I can't use their names, but some very top African-American politicians and top Democratic Party leaders said when the Clinton campaign cut off street money for Election Day in African-American areas, which is needed to help people get to the polls because they don't have limousines, okay?
Right.
You know, so when they cut off the street money to help people get to the polls, you know, in Philadelphia,
right,
in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, my God, what did you expect to happen?
In Michigan.
You know, and so once again, you know, no one's going to talk about the real threat to democracy in America, and it ain't from some hacker in his mommy's bedroom in Moscow. It's from the suppression of the black, Hispanic, and Asian American vote, the young voters, and now they're going after women. You don't take that on, and you're going to lose and lose and lose.
And lose big and lose repeatedly. I got to stop you there. Greg Palast, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is the book, and you can go to gregpalast.com. You can go to Amazon. You can go to Prime, and you can get his movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. As always, Greg, appreciate it.
Thanks, Doctor.
Take care. All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The man accused of burning down three churches in Louisiana has been charged with hate crimes. The man who stands accused of setting three African-American churches on fire in the span of 10 days, St. Mary's Baptist Church on March 26th, Greater Union Baptist Church on April 2nd, and Mount Pleasant Baptist Church on April 4th, has not only been charged with arson, he's now facing three hate crime charges as well. The St. Landry Parish District Attorney Earl Tyler filed the charges against Holden Matthews on Monday. What does this say about the rising of hate crimes in America? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. First, he's the senior pastor of Centerpoint Baptist Church and board member of the Baptist Convention of D.C. and vicinity pastor Orlando Bago. Pastor Bago, welcome to the Critical Hour, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We are also joined by the director of the Black Lives Matter PAC and vice president of the Missouri NAACP, Kenny Murdoch. Kenny, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me on.
Pastor Bago, let me start with you. Your thoughts, particularly as a pastor, when you heard of these three churches in St. Landry Parish, Louisiana, being burned, your thoughts?
My initial thoughts are it is a continuation of the bias that has been shown towards African-American congregations throughout this nation. This is not new occurrences for us, nor is it a rise of hate crimes around black churches. That if you look back even going to 1956, that on average there's been at least two African-American congregations throughout this nation that have been targeted by hate crimes. And so what we see is a continuation of these biases that have been shown to people of color.
Kenny Murdoch, same question to you. When you heard about these three churches being burned to the ground in the course of 10 days, your thoughts?
I was scared that white supremacists have been emboldened by the current political environment, and that has led them to look at soft targets. Traditionally, African-American churches have always been soft targets for racial hate, from blowing up young girls going to worship to now burning black churches, which not only happened in Louisiana, but there was some arson in black churches here in Missouri. What we fear is actually happening, and that is emboldened white supremacists are looking for soft targets to create panic, fear, and actually push forward a racist agenda.
What we know is historically, the black church has been the center of the black community, and that targeting these churches has been nothing but an act of terror. The whole purpose of setting the church on fire, burning the church to the ground, has nothing to do with the actual structure itself. It has to do with what that structure represents within the community being targeted. Pastor Bago.
Absolutely. It is controlling a dominant narrative that is centered in fear. And so if you keep the mentality of people afraid to speak up, speak out, and stand up against these acts of violence, then you continue to control how they operate in society. And so what we have here is this neo-paganism that is grounded in neo-Nazi ideology. The weapon in their arsenal today is fear. It is to keep people afraid of standing up and speaking out against these issues. Particularly when you look at this instance of Matthews. Here's a young man who is 21 years old, and so you have to question where does he get his ideology from? And his father is a state trooper or a local sheriff.
Sheriff deputy.
And so now you're dealing with some cultural context and dynamics that this isn't something that he's learned outside, right? One can argue that this is nurtured behavior. And so now one has to question that even there in Louisiana, then what becomes the ramification even of this young man being prosecuted, and now how are black communities again going to be targeted because this sheriff's deputy's son is now on trial?
Kenny Murdoch, and to just move to another element of this, there was this tie to this music called black metal, which I've never heard, but I'm told that there was also black metal music tied to Norway and some churches being burned in Norway.
Well, white supremacists have always had this music genre, death metal or heavy metal, this very aggressive, heavy genre of music. But in a way, I've always felt that they were still reacting to the fact that African-American culture has produced so much music for our society. They wanted to produce their own or kind of say that we could produce our own music. That music is used in websites like Stormfront. That music is used in white supremacist videos that they put out. And that music is getting spread around. But what it does is spread a message of hate and, once again, adds to that emboldenment of white supremacists to carry out action. What we must do as a community is really look at what they're choosing as targets. They're choosing the churches because churches are quintessential to African-American life. We run community groups through churches. We worship and bring our families to churches. The church is the center for a lot of African-Americans. So what we must do is strengthen our own faith communities, have our own people watching our churches, and make sure that other churches, allied churches that we know in the neighborhood, make sure that they're not going into disrepair and becoming easier, softer targets, and really use the community of faith to heal ourselves and protect ourselves.
I'm glad that Holden Matthews was charged with a hate crime. But one of the things that I find very interesting, the way that these stories are covered. Dylan Roof, the 23-year-old who murdered 9 African-Americans at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston. These continue to be treated as isolated incidents, almost as one-offs. We don't hear, in terms of mainstream media, discussion about a collective mindset and a serious problem that is systemic and historic within the United States. Pastor Bagel.
Absolutely. Since June 2015, with Dylan Roof and Mother Emanuel, there's been 7 reported hate crimes against African-American congregations in the United States. 7. And so if you go back to 1956 and you're talking about a total of 91, you know, at some time you have to sit back and begin to look at the epidemic that is plaguing our community. And you have to begin to look to an administration who is willing to call in the Justice Department to begin to look at these hate crimes more in depth, not just the attacks themselves on African-American communities, but what is propagating this ideology that one can do it, right? What is this undercurrent, this underlying bias? And my fear is that even in this current administration, and this whole notion of making America great again, that's a rallying call, a signal to those who have been lying in wait, that now it's time to come back to this notion of white is superior and blacks are inferior.
Kenny, before you respond, let me give just a little data here. U.S. hate groups rose 30%. In recent years, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. For the 4th year in a row, the Southern Poverty Law Center, a civil rights organization that tracks hate groups, reports that hate crimes and domestic extremism are rising in an unabated trend. The center found a 30% increase in U.S. hate groups over the past 4 years and a 7% increase in hate groups in 2018 alone. This is according to their Year in Hate and Extremism report. The group designated 1,020 organizations as hate groups in 2018, a high of at least 20 years. And what I think we have to understand is that not only do we attribute this to the rhetoric and a lot of the policy initiatives that have been initiated by our current president, Donald Trump, we also have to go back and look at this really kicked off with the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president. In fact, he was, without a doubt, according to statistics and data from the Secret Service, the most threatened presidential candidate in the history of this country. So there's a historical context that this conversation must stay in. Kenny.
I do believe America had a racist, allergic reaction to the first black president. And that allergic reaction led to the formation of like the Proud Boys, those white supremacist group that they may wear better clothes now, but their ideology is still as ugly as it ever was. And I think also you have to look at, in 2006, the Federal Bureau of Investigation put out a report that said white supremacists were trying to invade law enforcement and become members of law enforcement and have hidden agenda. They call them ghost badges. And these ghost badges, they will work in departments. So what we must now look at is, where did white supremacy seek into our society? Are they our elected officials? Are they our police officers? And we must start to have plans to root that ideology out of the departments that are supposed to protect and serve us. because you can't have both ideologies. You can't be a good police officer protecting and serving the community and hold white supremacy in your mind at the same time.
Well, except that, and Pastor Bago, I'll let you respond, except that when we understand the actual history of policing and police forces in this country, then that's exactly the mindset that, and two, to your point about the ghost badges, that's a great point, but you have to expand it another sentence or two and understand that not only are they infiltrating our police forces, they're infiltrating our military, getting trained in military, coming out of the military, and then getting jobs as cops.
Absolutely. I think Kenny makes an excellent point when he talks about the infiltration into our police departments. But we live in a day where we're dealing with Jane Esquire, right? And so there's this notion that that even the 30% rise in hate crimes across America is looking at America in its totality. So you're dealing with hate crimes against churches, hate crimes against persons of color, hate crimes against minorities, against women's, against the LGBTQ community, and this really serves to feed this notion that one can mirror that of even apartheid in South America, in South Africa, right? And although white European males might be in the minority, they still want to hold the power, right? And this is a power struggle. We know that the melting pot in America is shifting drastically, and so white men are no longer going to be the dominant, right? But yet they learn how to control the power, and that's the same thing that happened in South Africa. Who controls the resources? Who controls the legislation? Who controls the financial institution? Who controls all of these different constructs that happen in our civilization and our country? And so what we have now is if we can have them control our police departments, if we can have them control our legislative bodies, if we can have them control our military, then they use that power to control us as a people and continue to put fear in our minds and in our hearts to keep us relegated to a place of the backseat.
Kenny, your thoughts?
I agree wholeheartedly with the saying. We must use our power, and part of our power is not only voting, but knowing who are the people in our community to make decisions. We should know the police chief of our community. We should know the county prosecutor in our community. And we should make sure those people can say Black Lives Matter without sarcasm or without any type of backstepping or rolling back of that. We need to be proactive in all aspects of leadership in our society. And I think that starts with our faith groups and in the churches.
Pastor Bago, you just made the point about who controls the financial institutions. And just this past week, there were, I think, 7 CEOs of the major banks in this country. They were testifying before Congress. And Representative Al Green from Texas asked the panel of chief executives to raise their hands if they were not white men. He went through this whole process, and it's something that people should really go and look at because it was really, really, I think, brilliant. And the point that he was making was it's time for that lock on the finance end of this country to be broken. And in fact, he even asked anybody raise their hand if the person who's going to succeed you will be other than a white man, and they could not raise their hands. I want to make a quick point on the historic context here. When the horrific synagogue shooting took place in Pittsburgh, that horrific atrocity was put in a broader historic atrocity that Jews have suffered in this world for a very, very long time. It wasn't even something that people had to think about. It was just immediately put into the broader narrative as it should be. My point is, unfortunately, when these things continue to happen in the African-American community, they are not put in that broader context. And I want to take that point to this point. The cathedral in France, Notre Dame, burned horrifically day before yesterday. And there is now this worldwide movement to gather money to rebuild that church, as there should be. But we don't find the same clarion call and the same response as black churches are being burned to the ground. Now I understand, as a result of Notre Dame, there has been an uptick in contributions. I want to say they needed like $2 or $3 million to rebuild these churches. Pastor Bagel, your thought?
It's a devaluation of people, particularly people of African-American descent. And so historically speaking, we have always been marginalized, right? Devalued as a person. And even our Constitution speaks to that.
In a number of areas.
And whether you're talking about us being three-fifths of a human, if you're talking about,
the fugitive
slave provision, right? And so there's always been this perpetuation of how African Americans are viewed. And therefore, they are still seen as a marginalized group of people who have no value, who have no social constructs. And so when their institutions are burned, or when they are murdered, or when their women, are abused, then there's no clarion call. There's no cry, for this society to come together and support them. My challenge is, surely that it is heart-wrenching to see Notre Dame burn to the ground. But the Catholic Church has a $60 billion plus institution.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need our support. So I challenge any faith institution that is listening here today, or any philanthropic group that wants to give to those institutions that are in our community, give to those churches and parishes and communities that are serving the least, the last, and the lost. Give to them that they can continue to give back to those who our gospel say are the poor and who will be with us always.
Kenny Murdoch, you have the last word here.
I would say let's stay tenacious with some of the facts here, and let's look in the future if Governor of Louisiana John Bel Edwards, if he ups hate crime funding in his next budget. I think we have to fight on all fronts. We have to improve our community, put money in our community. We also have to hold those elected officials very accountable for what they do or they don't do after the fact. If Louisiana doesn't put more funding into hate crimes after these hate crimes happen, it shows what they really think of us through leadership.
Well, Senior Pastor of Centerpoint Baptist Church, Pastor Orlando Bagel, thank you very much. Director of the Black Lives Matter PAC and Vice President of the Missouri NAACP, Kenny Murdoch. Kenny, thank you very much for both of y'all's contributions to the Critical Hour. Thank you so much, Pastor Bagel, for coming in. And thank you again, gentlemen, for your contribution. Well, all right, folks, you have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.